Bien, je vous propose de commencer le séminaire. Merci de vous asseoir. And I'll switch to English to welcome our host today, Professor Noah Goodman, who came all the way from Stanford, from California. Professor Goodman is one of the most noted specialists of the Bayesian brain, the idea that we can understand some of the brain computations by thinking of it as a statistician. And a rational statistician who does rational computation. So he'll tell us a lot about this. I want to mention that he is a pure mathematician by training. So it's quite remarkable to have pure mathematicians coming in the field of cognitive science and cognitive psychology. And I also want to mention that he did his postdoc with Josh Tenenbaum, who is like the father of a large number of people working in the Bayesian perspective, including Steve Piantadosi, who was the first speaker of this seminar this year. So from Steve Piantadosi to Noah Goodman, we have a sort of bracketing of this perspective of rational development in human children, human infants as well. And the last thing I would like to mention is that Noah has published a number of very important articles, but also a book. It's a book by Noah Goodman and Steve, Josh Tenenbaum. And the book is available online. It's very interesting for its content, but also for its form. It was published officially, I think, 2014. But in fact, it keeps evolving online, and it's completely free and available. And not only that, but it's an interactive book. So whenever there is the mention of a particular Bayesian model, for instance, you can immediately play with the equations, play with the programs, and see the results online. It's called the Probabilistic Models of Cognition, right? And so you can find it online, and it's really a good way to learn more about this Bayesian perspective. So without further ado, Professor Noah Goodman.
Thanks, Dan. I'm really pleased to be here. So today what I want to talk about is broadly the question of how it is that people come to know so much, how people come to know so much. If you think about it, there's a remarkable thing that happens between when a baby is born and when they become an adult, which is that they go from knowing, I want to say nothing, but at least very little, to being capable of being part of modern society. They can be a rocket scientist, they can work on whatever high-tech farm thing that is, they can write plays. And in order to do all of that, they have to have a deep, profound, and really broad base of knowledge. They have to know a lot of concepts and know how to use them. And so the question that has been haunting cognitive science for centuries, well, millennia really, is the problem of induction. How is it that people come to know so much from so little? And by little here, I mean very little in terms of time on the scheme of things. 20 years is not very long. And also very little in terms of data. We don't actually see that many things in the world in the 20 years that we have to become adults. So how is it that we nonetheless can become productive members of society? So the basic question here starts out with a picture that you might say is this is the kind of narrow classical cognitive psychology view of this question. We see some examples in the world, and from those examples, we form some kind of mental representation of a concept. I'm going to come back to the examples in a minute. This is just an icon to remind you that we see some examples. And the question is, what is the representation of the concept and how does it get there? And so the classic Bayesian school of cognitive psychology answer has two parts. Okay, really this is my version of that from a few years ago. And the plan of this talk is I'm first going to tell you about my version of this story, this Bayesian story, and then I'm going to tell you a bunch of ways that I recently think it's wrong and we should change it. So first let me show you the idea. So it has two parts. The first part is that we need some representational basis. The representational basis, that's a fancy way of saying the pieces that we can use to put together ideas. This is often called a language of thought. So a language of thought is some way of building complex concepts from simple pieces. I'm not going to go into the philosophical background, but the idea is if we have a way of building complicated concepts out of simple pieces, it helps explain the puzzle of how it's possible that there's infinitely many different ideas we could possibly learn, even though we didn't see most of them in our evolutionary history. Okay, so the first part is that we're going to have a language of thought, which is going to be a broad space of possible concepts built out of simple pieces. And then the second piece is that we're going to have some powerful mechanism that allows us to go from observed examples in the world to concepts in that language of thought. It's very simple, right? Okay, we're all done now. I can go home. Yeah. So before I jump into the mathematical details here, I just want to give you a sense of what experiments look like to test these ideas. And this goes back to the early days of cognitive psychology. Really, it goes back to Brunner in the 1950s, Jerome Brunner. But I just want to show you an experiment, a classic experiment by Medin and Schaefer. So these Boolean concept learning experiments would proceed like this. They're very simple. I'd show you some objects, those bugs, and I'd say, there's a new kind of bug called a quep. Oh yeah, and since English is not your first language for many of you, quep is not an English word. It's a nonsense word, okay. So there's a new kind of bug called a quep. These are queps, and these are not queps. Okay, so now your job is just to figure out what a quep is. Don't look too closely. The features are kind of blurry in these reproductions. And then we might ask a question like, taking these away, we might ask you, so this one, do you think that's a quep? Out of curiosity, how many people think that's a quep? How many think it's not a quep? Oh, that was a beautiful replication. Okay, so here's the data. What I'm showing you is the percent of the human participants who said, yes, that is a quep. And I'm showing it for this one, which was not in the training set, the examples I showed you, as well as the ones that were labeled as queps and the ones that were labeled as not queps. And there's three important qualitative features of this data. The first is it's graded. It's not that everybody says it's a quep and then everybody says it's not a quep. Instead, there's gradation in the portion of people who think a given item is a quep. Next is what's called typicality. So even within the positive examples, the ones that I said were queps, once you take them away and ask, is this a quep, some of them turn out to be much better examples than others in the sense that people sort of later on think it is a quep as opposed to not. And the final one is this effect. It's called prototype enhancement, where this object, which was never seen as either a quep or not a quep when I gave you the examples, is nonetheless judged to be better than any of the labeled examples. So this is more certainly a quep than any of these. And actually, you guys just did that beautifully. It's funny, I almost never try that because I assume that it's, well, okay, neat. Okay, so now what I want to do is take this kind of simple Boolean concept learning setting and tie it to the much broader and more abstract picture. So the first step is to say how we can go from the examples to some kind of mental representation. And for that, we need a powerful learning mechanism. Okay, this is where the Bayes comes in. So Bayes' rule is probably the most important little mathematical formula in science. And it simply is a way of telling you how good a hypothesis is given some data that you've seen. So what we have on the left is exactly that. This is called the posterior probability. It's the probability of a given hypothesis about the data, given some data. And Bayes' rule says that you can evaluate a hypothesis by just looking at two terms. You need to look at the prior probability, so how much did you believe that hypothesis before you saw any data? And you need to look at what's called the likelihood. This is the probability that you would have actually seen that data if the hypothesis were true. And Bayes' rule basically says, okay, that means that if you write down a likelihood and you write down a prior, then if somebody hands you some data and hands you a hypothesis, you can say, how good is that hypothesis? And then you can, for instance, compare two different hypotheses and decide which one better explains the data. Okay, so to apply this to the setting that I told you about, and in particular the language of thought view, the next thing that we have to do is describe where we're going to get the hypotheses from. So a hypothesis for these Boolean concept learning things is something like this sentence. It's a quep if it has flat head and round wings. Now, if you stare at that for a while, and you're of the right persuasion, you'll first of all notice that it has some pieces which are direct perceptual features. Okay, so simple features, has flat head, round wings. In addition, we take those simple perceptual features and we combine them together with a little word in English that carries more than its weight, and. And so from that we get the idea, and I alluded to this already, that we should build the hypotheses like this by combining together features using what are sometimes called composition rules, basically just ways of putting together pieces. So a little bit more formally, we can capture this idea of combining the pieces together by saying we start with a template that says quep if rule. Now rule isn't actually the rule. Rule is something that we need to now go and fill in. So we write down things that rule could turn into. So rule could just turn into a feature like has flat head, and then we'd be done. Or rule could turn into a different rule combined with and with yet another rule, okay? Or just so we have some diversity, we could combine together two sub-rules with or. Okay, so the idea is if we start with quep if rule, and then we keep choosing one of these, right? Maybe we choose the and first, and then we choose a feature, and then we choose another feature. Eventually, we won't have that italics rule anymore, and instead, what we'll have is a concrete specific rule, like it's a quep if it has flat head and round wings. So that's a grammar. That's what's called a grammar in linguistics and psychology. And it's a beautiful thing because out of some very simple basic pieces, we're able to derive a potentially infinite space of different rules. We just keep recursively applying this process of expanding from rule to one of these longer things on the right side. Oh yeah, and I should have said this, but in math, if you want everything to look more confusing than it actually has to be, we would write and with this little wedge, and we would write the features as little functions. But really, this is just an iconic way of representing something like it's a quep if it has flat head and round wings. I'll use this as the icon because it makes it look much more sophisticated than it actually is. Okay, so this gives us a way of describing the different hypotheses that we want to entertain. But it doesn't yet quite give us the key thing that we need, which is the prior probability, how much we believe in each of those hypotheses before we see any data. It turns out that it's really simple to do that, though. What we do is we take our grammar and we just add a probability to each of the rules. So we say, okay, if I see rule, then 50% of the time I'm going to just turn it into a specific feature. 30% of the time I'll turn it into this rule and rule. And 20% of the time into rule or rule. Now that means that as I'm expanding, each time I have to replace italics rule with one of the right-hand side things, there's a certain probability that I make each of the choices. Each step is very simple, and each probability at each step is just, you know, you can imagine rolling a dice and looking and seeing what number comes up to decide which of these three things you should use. But if you put that together overall, it means that the probability of getting a specific rule is the probability that you make each of the choices that you would have to make to get to that rule. And because longer rules require more choices, they're also going to have lower probability. So in other words, what we've got from these simple pieces is a probability over the space of all of the rules, which automatically assigns lower probability to longer rules. That's a really good feature because what it means is that you have an Occam's razor built in. You have a complexity bias that says, I like shorter, simpler rules compared to longer rules, without having to express that in a direct way. It just comes out of the fact that you have to keep making choices to get longer rules. Okay, so for us, that means now we have this picture. We imagine that a person sees some examples, uses Bayes' rule, and in order to use Bayes' rule, they start with this hypothesis space where a grammar gives a language of, quote-unquote, language of thought, a space of rules, together with the prior probability that favors shorter rules. We need to specify the likelihood, and for now what I'm going to do is use a likelihood which is the simplest likelihood you can imagine. If you have a rule and you want to decide whether a particular bird is a quep, then the simplest thing is just you apply the rule and see, does this rule say quep or not? We're going to almost use that. We're going to say use what the rule says with a high probability, and with a very low probability, do the opposite of what the rule says. So I've written this mathematically here. It's simply that a particular object is a quep. Given the rule says that the object is a quep, we will actually label it quep with some fixed, relatively high probability. And then with the low probability, it will be not a quep. So this is like the idea of having noisy observations. We simply assume that when we observe the label quep or not quep, there's a small chance it was wrong. Okay, so that's all we need in order to now have a fully specified model that goes from some observations to some rules. So let's compare it to human data. So what I'm showing you here is the revisiting the data from the Medin and Schaefer experiment, and I'm showing you on the y-axis the human data, just what I showed you before. For each of the objects, the probability that people say it's a quep. And on the x-axis, I'm showing you the probability according to this rule induction model that I just built up. Again, it's the probability that each of the objects is a quep. And when you look at a plot like this that shows you model versus human data, what you should be looking for is whether there's a line. If there's a line, it means that the predictions of the model are matching the actual human data. In this case, there is a line. It's very satisfying. The correlation between the human judgments and the model here is 0.99, which means that the model is explaining pretty much all of the variance in human responses for this data. In addition to the quantitative fit, it also captures the kind of key qualitative features that I mentioned. So there's, of course, gradedness. There's typicality within the examples of a concept. And there's this prototype enhancement effect where one of the unseen examples is judged as definitely belonging to the concept. And I should mention that the model that I showed you is a model that has one free parameter, which is that noise, the observation noise. What's the probability that an example was labeled wrong? And we fit that for this data. Okay, so that's one example. It's kind of neat that it works, but it shouldn't be terribly compelling because humans can learn lots and lots and lots of concepts, and we need to know that a model like this can explain lots and lots of concepts. So we've applied it to a lot of concepts. I just want to show you a few cases. Here, this is mostly just to say you can do it without cherry-picking the concepts. So we generated 43 random concepts, like the quep one, but just randomly generated, collected human judgments. And this is showing, in aggregate, the performance of the model at predicting judgments across the 43 random concepts. It, again, does quite well. This is an experiment I did with Steve Piantedosi. Maybe he already talked about it, but, well, it's nice to come back to something you heard at the beginning of the term. This is an experiment that's very, very much like the Boolean concept learning one. The difference is that each time we show people objects, we show them a set of objects. And the reason for that is because we're interested in some of the concepts where the actual rule depends on the context, on the set. So for instance, you could have a rule which is the unique largest object, or it's a quep if there's another one that has the same shape as it, right? So these are rules that are fundamentally relational as opposed to based on single features. and so what we wanted to do is do a very big experiment where we looked at both the simple Boolean concepts, like the one that I showed you, a bunch of them, and then some of these more relational context-dependent concepts. We did here 108 concepts, and we collected data from about 1,500 participants, which again allows us to look at much more of the breadth of the different concepts that are possible. Here's the aggregate data looking at the Boolean concepts. We see that the model predictions match the human responses quite well. Something that is an interesting possibility to do with this data, because we have quite a lot of it, is also to look at the trial-by-trial learning curves. So up to here, what I'm showing you is the aggregates ignoring when exactly somebody saw a particular example. In this experiment, since we're showing people trials one set at a time, and we show them in a fixed order, we can look at curves like this, which are showing for a particular trial, given all of the labeled examples that people have seen before, what fraction of people correctly guess the label of the next object. And you can see that, you know, overall people get to a high accuracy in these concepts by the end, but that early on there are some cases where there are these abrupt dips in performance. These correspond essentially to you're going along, you think you know what the rule is, and all of a sudden you get an example that surprises you, where you get it wrong. And so you're inaccurate on that one, but then you update your beliefs and you get a little bit better as you go along. And so we can ask whether the same Bayesian rule inference model is able to predict the trial by trial learning curves like this. The short answer, I'm just showing you sort of four examples of this. But overall, the model actually predicts the trial-by-trial learning curves extremely well across the data set. The correlations, you know, here I'm showing you correlations in the 0.9s, and that's about what it is across the data set. I'm not a neuroscientist, but, you know, we can also ask, is concept learning like this in the brain? Fortunately, it does turn out to be in the brain. That's all I really have to say about the brain. Concept learning is there. No, I'll say one more thing. So I did an experiment with Sam McClure and some of our students. And there's a really interesting thing that you can look at because you have the models. We did exactly the same experiment in the scanner. And now the model actually predicts two different quantities that are interesting. One quantity is the probability it assigns to the next answer. That's sometimes called the surprisal, the log of the probability of the next answer. And so when you get a really surprising example, that number is higher. In contrast, after you've seen an example, you change the distribution over rules according to the model. And so you can get a measure of how much the distribution over rules changes when you see an example. Technically, this is the Kullback-Leibler divergence, for those of you who like probability theory. And that's a measure of how much your beliefs change after you see an example. So we have these two different quantitative measures that come out of the model. One is how surprised you are by an example, and the other is how much an example changes your beliefs. Now, interestingly, those are somewhat correlated, but not perfectly correlated. And so we can take them and we can do a regression and ask, is there any signal in the brain that corresponds to the surprisal and to the belief updating signal? And then, you know, controlling for a bunch of other things like whether you get the trial right and things like that. And interestingly, this was a very kind of nice result. The surprisal signal correlates very strongly with a very small region in the striatum, which is exactly the region that other experiments have found corresponds to surprise signals in reinforcement learning. So this is a little region that projects dopamine signals through the rest of the brain and is generally thought to gate learning. Somewhat more interestingly, though, when we look at the belief updating signal, the belief updating signal is very strongly correlated with a region of the brain in the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. So it could have been that the belief updating signal that the model predicts wasn't sort of actually represented anywhere in the brain, or was represented in a very distributed way. Instead, it seems to be represented in this region of the brain that other research has sort of pointed out as being responsible for maintaining the task rule when you have to do a task. In other words, previous people have said, hey, this is where you put the rule when you have to do a simple task in the scanner. And what we're finding is that when your beliefs about the rule that are the rule that accounts for the concept learning experiment change, that same region of the brain is doing something. I wouldn't make a very strong inference, because it's doing something, but we don't actually know what. But I like seeing that it's somewhere. Okay, moving back to the cognitive psychology. So when I showed you the grammar for generating rules, I just wrote down a specific grammar. It's a pretty simple one. It takes features and it combines them together with conjunction and disjunction and or. But it would be perfectly natural to ask, is that the right language? And indeed, part of the reason we wanted to look at these relational examples is because the relational examples are ones where that you should not be able to handle with the simple Boolean propositional logic language that I wrote down. You should need relations and quantifiers. So what I'm showing you is two examples of the trial-by-trial learning data. Again, the red curve is the Boolean, quote-unquote, language of thought that I showed you. And it doesn't fit the data very well for concepts that have this relational character. So this one is, there exists another object with the same color. On the other hand, if we upgrade the language to include quantifiers, so there exists, every, there is exactly one, and there's none, then we get the prediction of the green curve, the model in the green curve. And that does now account pretty well for human learning. So this is a kind of an argument, a slightly weak argument, that we can back out the features that have to be in the representation, the language of thought, from the concept learning data that we collect in these experiments. Now, part of the reason we did a really broad experiment in this one is because we wanted to be able to do a data analysis where we more systematically ask, okay, what's the language of thought that accounts for concept learning, assuming this basic Bayesian learning mechanism. So on the left, I'm just showing you another one of these model versus data plots, which includes now all of the concepts in the experiment. And on the right, I'm showing you an inscrutable table that allows me to tell you about the results of this model comparison. So basically, we took a whole bunch of languages that varied systematically the set of properties that we allowed, and we just did a comparison. This is a fairly tricky model comparison, actually, for those of you who like to do Bayesian data analysis, because we have to infer a bunch of parameters of the model in each case and then compare it to held out data that was not part of the training for the model. So what these numbers are is the held out log likelihood, how well the model accounts for data that it hasn't seen before. and just to summarize the basic finding, there's a whole bunch of languages of thought that we can rule out as not explaining the data very well. These are ones that sound pretty weird to people, like electrical engineers really like NAND, not AND, as a basis for logic. It turns out that's not a good one to have in the language of thought. Similarly, having XOR, exclusive OR, directly in the language of thought is not so good, although you can build it up out of little pieces. The rest of the details don't matter very much, except that we definitely need quantifiers. And interestingly, the language which best was able to account for human data here was effectively the one that Frege wrote down when he was first claiming that logic was a good way of thinking about the world and human thought, which is a language that has most of the connectives and, or, and so on, and all of the quantifiers, including exactly one. That was actually a surprise when we found that out. Okay. I want to make so the summary so far is I've sort of argued and given you some evidence that when we want to think about how humans learn concepts from observed examples, we can do it with this two-part story. One part is there's a powerful language of thought that represents concepts, building complex concepts out of simple pieces. And the other part is Bayes' rule that tells you which concepts are good ones given the data that you've seen. So far, the story, I think, is a pretty solid story that I I like. I would endorse it. But there are a couple of dangling loose ends that have been bothering me for years. The first one is a relatively simple question. So Bayes' rule tells you how to evaluate a hypothesis once you have it in hand. You compute its likelihood and its prior. It doesn't actually tell you how to find the hypotheses in the first place. And when you have an infinite language of thought, that really is problematic. It's a big space of possible hypotheses to look through. So how do we find the candidate rules? Now, one answer that was given by Tomer Ullman and Josh Tenenbaum and myself is, well, maybe it's not really that hard. Maybe you can just do random search where you don't have to understand the details here, but this is sort of representing the Bayes rule metric of how good a particular hypothesis is. It's really jaggy, so it's very hard to move around that space. But maybe if you just randomly jump to nearby points and evaluate them, you're going to find sort of a good one in the end. Now, I'm not going to tell you the details here because this is not, in fact, the sort of big picture story I want you to come away with. I think this is a very good way of learning concepts when the concepts are not too very complicated and the input data that you're learning from is not too very large and unpleasant. On the other hand, it starts to break down when you try to scale up to very large, complicated situations. And this is something that I realized as I was making this talk. I don't have a single piece of data to point to for this point, but it's sort of something that all cognitive psychologists know, which is that people are not actually very good at learning. When you do an experiment on learning, you have to be very careful to make it simple enough that people in the experiment will understand what they're supposed to do and sort of be able to engage with the task. So in other words, concept learning actually gets hard for people very quickly when the concepts become complicated, when the data become large, and particularly when you have to learn a lot of concepts at the same time. So given the difficulty of concept learning when it scales up, we have to wonder, like, is that the whole story? And there's two answers to this. One answer, which is the answer I would have given you 10 years ago and probably maybe Josh Tenenbaum would give you now until you press him on it, is, yeah, that is the whole story. We see stuff in the world, and we have a powerful learning mechanism and some kind of search, which is maybe better than random search, and we form intuitive theories out of them. The other answer is no, that's not the whole story. We're individually able to learn simple things, but not able to learn complicated things. And so that leaves us in a bind. How do people end up having so much knowledge in their head if each individual person is not really that good at learning? An answer is that I think I like a lot these days. It's been talked about for a while, but Michael Tomasello really kind of said it most clearly and branded it very beautifully as the cultural ratchet. The answer is, well, limited individual learning can be amplified over time if there's a way in order to accumulate knowledge across generations. I learn a little bit, and then I don't learn enough to build a rocket ship, but I pass the little bit I learn along. Oh, I have a picture of this. I pass that little bit I learn along to the next generation. They learn a little bit more, and then pass what they know along. And before you know it, you know, a few thousand generations later, we have individuals who know a lot, even though they only learned a little bit directly from observations. Okay, so that idea of the cultural ratchet, transmission of knowledge from one person to another, is going to be a powerful way to accumulate knowledge if there's a method of faithfully transmitting concepts from one brain into another. Now, by faithful, what I mean is that the concept that this person learns should also be the concept that this person has after this transmission, whatever form it takes. So we could just claim that such a means of transmission exists. That's not very satisfying. We'd really like to study the mechanism. What exactly is it about human cognition that accounts for and supports faithful transmission of knowledge from one person to another? Because it's only if we can fill in some mathematical detail what goes there, as well as what goes there, that this cultural ratchet story really becomes a possible answer to the initial problem of induction. So when I first started getting excited about cultural ratchet some years ago, I thought, clearly people have already figured out the mechanism of the ratchet, because anthropologists and developmental psychologists and such people have been excited about this for quite a while. Unfortunately, when I dug in, I really didn't like the experimental paradigms that they were using, because on the anthropology side, they had extremely rich channels of transmission, arbitrary interaction in natural language, but they had really no ground truth to know whether the knowledge was faithfully transmitted. All they could say was that what people say changes over time. They couldn't say that you took something from one person and you got it to the next person. In cognitive psychology, people were trying to get at this more precisely, but in order to do it, they stripped down the channel here and they got rid of all of the interesting stuff that people have, and they said, okay, well, maybe the channel is, for instance, just showing examples. So you have examples here and you have examples here, and then you can do pretty solid experiments. I don't think that's right either. I think that the real story is that it's something about interaction and probably natural language that actually supports faithful transmission. So we struggled with this for a while, and we kept doing experiments that were too complicated to actually run. And eventually we came up with a paradigm that I think is very nice and very simple. And it's also very new. We just submitted this, so you know there's probably lots of flaws here. But the basic idea is that we're going to start with Boolean concept learning paradigm, just like the one that I showed you already. We're going to bring in somebody who I'll call the teacher and just train them up on a Boolean concept. We show them a bunch of labeled examples. Meanwhile, the person that I'm going to call the student is hanging around waiting. And then we pair them up, and we're doing this online. So by pair them up, I mean we drop them both into a chat room like this. It's like instant messaging on your phone. And in that chat room, we allow them to say whatever they want back and forth between them. So they have an unconstrained natural language channel for communicating. But critically, we know exactly what goes on in that channel, right? We're recording everything that they say. And then after the instructions here are that the teacher should tell the student about the concept. Then after they're done with that, the student can say, okay, I think I know enough, and go on. And then we separate them again, and we test them exactly the way that one would test them in a standard Boolean concept learning experiment, just like before. So critically, this person, effectively, we just did the same experiment I showed you before. We showed them examples, we let them observe examples, and then we tested them to see what concept they had learned. But this person never directly sees any training examples. They only get input from the other person in the form of natural language, and then we test them in the same way. And because we're testing them in exactly the same way, this allows us to ask whether the concept learned by the first person is the concept that is now known by the second person. Oh, and at the end, we tell them how well both the teacher and the student did, and we pay them according to how well the student did. So they're incentivized to transmit information in this situation. It's a cooperative game. Okay, so here's one view of the results of this experiment. So we did it with 5 different unique rules realized in each rule realized in 10 specific items. So basically 50 different concepts. Here I'm aggregating across the rules. And I'm showing you in solid colors the teacher's accuracy, and in vague colors, the student's accuracy. And the big takeaway from this is that the student is nearly as accurate as the teacher. And I'll remind you that the student never saw any labeled examples directly. The only information they have is from the teacher. So the teacher is an upper bound on their possible accuracy. And they're very close to that upper bound. Another way to look at this is to do a standard regression analysis, a mixed effects regression. So here we did a regression where the role as student or teacher was a fixed effect, the concept was a fixed effect, and then there were all the random effects you could want. And when you take the beta weight and then you standardize it back onto the accuracy measure, what you get is that students are indeed less accurate than teachers, but only about 5%, which is actually quite small, considering how bad you could be at this task. So we can conclude that in this task, language is actually a sufficient channel for faithful transmission of concepts. Language is enough to get a concept from one head into another. We can then ask some more details about this. The next question you might be wondering is how the teacher and student accuracies relate to each other. And so this is another view of the data where I'm showing student accuracy on the x-axis and teacher accuracy on the y-axis. And that lets us basically just ask, you know, for a particular concept, is the accuracy of teachers a good predictor of the accuracy of students? Similar to the regression, but just viewed in a slightly different way. And you see that there's a pretty strong correlation. I think for the single concept as opposed to aggregated by rule view, the correlation is about 0.65. So it's a pretty strong correlation. So what that tells you is that when a teacher is not very good at a particular concept, the student also is not very good at that concept. There's a more fine-grained question that you can ask, which I think is more interesting, which is, do the students make the same mistakes as their teachers? Because they were answering all the same questions in the final phase of the experiment, we can just compare. So if we do that, you can, mathematically this is called a Hamming distance, but that's a fancy way of just saying, count up how many times the teacher and the student gave different answers in the test phase. Because there were 50 questions, the upper bound on that is 50, which is sort of up here. Lower bound is 0. That's if they answer exactly the same on every question. The result here is that, on average, teachers and students differ in about 11 particular places. I didn't actually show the baseline here, but you can do an analysis where you randomly permute teachers and students within a particular concept. So that is, take a student and replace their teacher with a teacher who saw exactly the same training data initially, and then ask for that randomly permuted teacher, how well do these two Hamming distance numbers agree? And what you find is that the students are much more similar, I shouldn't say much, the students are more significantly more similar to the answers of their own teacher than a randomly permuted other teacher by somewhere around 2.5 or 3 specific items. And you can do the same permutation test with respect to an arbitrary teacher in the data set, and then of course the difference is bigger. I threw in this figure because I think it's really interestingly suggestive. You can ask, how does the similarity between a teacher and their student relate to the actual accuracy of teachers on the concept? And what you find is that as the teachers become more accurate, they are much better at transmitting whatever they believe to the student. I think that what this means, although it's only indirect evidence, is that the more confused the teacher is, the less well they can use language to convey whatever's in their head to the student. I'd like to do some little follow-ups to make sure that this accuracy actually corresponds to certainty or uncertainty. Okay, moving on, we can ask another question about this data. So far what I basically said is that language can support the cultural ratchet by getting a concept from one person's head into another person's head. I want to ask now two other questions. I want to ask first, how efficient is language? This is a hard question, and so this analysis is just a first stab. But in our experiment, both the initial learning phase for the teacher and the communication phase were self-paced. So we let the teacher study the examples as long as they wanted, and then we let the pair of teacher-student communicate as long as they wanted. And so if we're willing to take the time that they do each of those things as a proxy for how much effort they put into learning, then we can think about efficiency in terms of the time spent. So basically what I'm showing you here is for each concept, that's the circles, I'm showing you on average how much time was spent learning from observations or from language. What you see is that the lines connecting a concept in observation to the same concept in language generally slope down, I think almost all slope down, And what that means is that less time was spent when learning from language than when learning from observations. If I stop there, then I think that would be a good argument for language being, in fact, more efficient as a way of learning a concept than observations. I don't actually want you to overinterpret this data, though, because there's a lot of things in these timing numbers that are contingent on the specific experiment I did. So for instance, in this setup, we required the teacher to click on all of the examples to reveal the label, just to make sure that they would engage and actually look at them. And so it's possible that they took a little bit longer because they were just busy clicking than they would have if we had just showed them the examples. Simple things like that. So I think this is very suggestive that language is actually not only sufficient, but a much more efficient way to get a concept, but follow-ups required. Okay, and the last cool thing about this data is we have the language. So we don't have to just say language is sufficient. We can look at the language that teachers and students actually used, and we can ask what language is actually used to convey concepts. And this is much more fine-grained than just saying it's social interaction or it's language. We can say what language specifically supports concept learning. So in our data set, what we did is we went and we took all of the messages sent between teacher and student, and we hand-coded, this was painful, we hand-coded them according to a bunch of linguistic categories of the particular linguistic constructs that showed up. Here what I'm showing you is a histogram for all of the messages that were relevant to the concept, so not the messages like, hi, how you doing, which was about 30% of the corpus. So of all of the relevant messages, sort of the class that they fell in. Now, importantly, it was entirely possible for the teachers to teach by talking about specifics, right? They could have talked about the specific examples that they had seen. Like they could have said, I saw one quep that had orange wings, or they could have said, I saw five queps with orange wings and a head. So they could have done that with sort of numerics. They could have done, if it's a quep, then it has orange wings. They could have used imperatives, like just click on all the ones with orange wings. Instead, what we see is that the vast majority of the informative messages are these two kinds of linguistic constructs, generics and quantifiers. So generics are sentences like, queps have orange feathers. And quantifiers are sentences like, all queps have orange feathers. These are very similar constructs, which are special in language because they're exactly the semantic, the pieces of language that support conveying generalizations about categories. So this leads, I think, to a very probably overly strong version of the cultural ratchet idea. It's the claim that the cultural ratchet arises specifically not just out of language, but out of the ability of language to convey generalizations, and even more specifically through generics and quantifiers. So the picture then at this point is, okay, individuals can learn, and they learn using something like Bayes' rule and a language of thought, but then critically they can generate language in order to teach another person who will then have the same concept in their head, and that the language they use is generic language like this. Queps have orange feathers. There's still one piece that I need to fill in, though, in order to really pin this down in a precise way, which is here I was very precise about the mathematical relation between the examples and the concept. Here I haven't told you anything about the mathematical relation between a generic sentence and a concept, right? So if I can fill in this arrow with a little bit of math, then I'll feel much better that I've told you a story about how knowledge gets there. So that's the last piece of the talk, and I understand I'm running short on time. Do I have 10-ish minutes? Yeah? Okay, great. So let's just talk about generics for a minute. Generics are a wonderful and strange piece of language. They're wonderful because they're very good at, they're extremely natural. So morphologically, they're simple. Wugs have red legs is basically just a category and a feature. And actually, cross-linguistically, generics are expressed, and they're expressed in a morphologically very simple way. By that, I mean you don't have a whole lot of extra words that you need in order to say the generic. They're also very early in development. So kids get generics from as soon as they start talking. Parents will use generic sentences. They'll say things like, "Wugs have red legs." They also start producing generics very early when they start speaking. In fact, way before quantifier is another category language. That's work of Henry Wellman and Susan Gelman. But generics are very, very fishy beasts. So let me just give you the example. So when you hear "Wugs have red legs," you probably infer that almost all wugs have red legs. Everybody think almost all wugs? On the other hand, if I tell you wugs have broken wings, maybe you don't think that almost all of them have broken wings. Maybe you just think like a small but surprising number. This is even clearer when you are saying yes or no to a generic instead of sort of interpreting it. So mosquitoes carry malaria sounds like a perfectly good sentence, even though a very, very small fraction of mosquitoes actually carry malaria. Similarly, birds lay eggs sounds totally fine, even though about half of birds, the female ones, lay eggs. On the other hand, birds are female does not sound like a good sentence, even though it's the exact same birds. So these are the kind of puzzles that have bothered philosophers when they've been trying to understand what generics are. And so I want to sort of basically provide two possible ideas about where the meaning of a generic could come from, and then I'm going to explore it mathematically in just the next slide or two. So one idea is that, hey, you know, if I say queps have orange feathers, in some sense that's a minimal example. If I show you this bird and I say it's a quep, you see that it has orange feathers, but you also see that it has big eyes and a yellow beak and lots of other features. And so in some sense, by just highlighting the feathers and saying, you know, queps and that feature, I've given you a minimal example that should make learning a little bit easier, right? It's a quep and it has this feature. And so one idea about generics is that that's what they are. They are simply minimal examples that just give you the category and the one feature. Another idea about generics is that they are not only giving you that minimal example, they are also purposefully giving you that minimal example. So they're, you know, this is my cartoon of saying, hey you there, look, this is a quep and it has orange feathers. So another way of saying that is that generics are minimal examples that have social force. They're intended examples. So what I want to do is try to cash out these two ideas about generics and then do another little experiment to compare them. So it turns out that the math for writing these two ideas down is relatively simple and beautiful. It starts with a slightly unusual assumption, which is let's assume that the probability, so let's assume we're talking about a generic where there's a feature F and a category C. So F is something like orange feathers, and C is something like quep, okay? And there's a probability that you have that feature if you're in the category. We sometimes call that the prevalence, and I'm just going to denote that with R. So R is the probability that you have orange feathers if you're a quep. The learner who hears the generic, queps have orange feathers, is trying to infer, we're going to assume, that prevalence R. Now this is a case, so again we're just going to use Bayes' rule. Here's an example of Bayes' rule. But this is a funny example of Bayes' rule where the likelihood is the hypothesis itself, right? So the hypothesis is the prevalence of orange feathers for queps. What we're getting is one example of a quep with orange feathers, and so the probability that it would have orange feathers if it's a quep is that prevalence. And so that's why the likelihood just is that prevalence R. And then the prior is some prior that we're going to need to measure. So we get this simple model coming from Bayes' rule that says that the probability of a prevalence given that you hear the generic should be proportional to the prevalence times some prior over prevalences. Okay, what about the social force? So there's been a very nice kind of emergence in computational psycholinguistics of models of, well, social force, of intended meaning. That's often called pragmatics in linguistics. And there's this base of models that we've called the Rational Speech Act models. And they basically just talk about how you can realize that pragmatic structure of language by making inference models that don't just ground out directly in the examples, but ground out first in knowledge about how a speaker chooses utterances. Okay, so that's a complicated way of saying what's written down here, which is we say, okay, when a speaker decides whether to say the generic or not, if they're trying to convey a particular prevalence R, they think, okay, is the listener going to correctly interpret the utterance? And the probability that a speaker uses an utterance is just going to be proportional to the probability that the listener would recover the right interpretation. With that in mind, then, you can have a fancier listener. This is called a pragmatic listener. And the pragmatic listener just uses Bayes' rule again, but Bayes' rule where the likelihood now is given by their model of the speaker. How likely is a speaker to have used that, that particular utterance given a target prevalence? Okay, so what we have is two models, what I'll call the L0, so simple listener model, and then the L1, complicated social listener model. The social listener reasons about a speaker who reasons about a listener. That's what makes it social. And now we want to test these two models against data. And there's one thing standing in our way, which is that both of the models need the prior probability across prevalences. And now just to explain that, this is going to be a prior knowledge distribution of how the prior probability that a given category will have a prevalence across different categories. It's kind of a complicated piece of knowledge, and there's no way to, I think, make an just assumption about it that's reasonable. So instead what we went is we did an elicitation experiment to just measure this knowledge. And basically, it looks something like this. We gave a whole bunch of categories, and we asked them to fill in some more categories. And then we asked them to say the prevalence across all of those categories and a whole bunch of different features. And then we did some Bayesian data analysis thing to take that data and turn it into the prevalence prior that we need. The key takeaway here is that we measured those prevalence beliefs from people for different features. In order to plug it into the model that we're going to use to predict judgments. And I'll just point out that the key thing about these prevalence priors is that different features have priors that have quite different shapes. So for instance, caries malaria, most categories have a very small fraction of that category carrying malaria, whereas R-red has this bimodal distribution where either relatively few members of the category are red, or almost all members of the category are red. And it's a longer story that I don't have time for, but that's basically why this model predicts those extreme variation in generic endorsement and whether you say yes to a generic. Okay, so then we did an experiment where we got interpretation data. So basically, this is equivalent to taking a feature, so perform in the circus, use tools, eat grass, and just saying, hey, there's a new kind of animal. Somebody who's studying this animal tells you, queps eat grass. What fraction of queps do you think eat grass? That's the experiment. And I'm showing you the data here just to emphasize that there's a huge amount of gradation in the interpreted prevalence given the generic utterance, right? These are the interpreted prevalence data. Then we can compare to those two models. And what I'm showing you on the left, oops, I didn't label it, is the relation between the human data and the model prediction from that social version of the model, the fancy model that does reasoning about the speaker. And the relation is extremely tight, even taking into account uncertainty in the priors. So the model is able to predict human interpretations very well. And what I'm showing you on the left is a standard Bayesian model comparison between the simple model and the complex social model. This is the log likelihood of the data and showing there's a couple of hundred log points difference, which for those of you who aren't used to interpreting those plots, that's a really, really big difference. that you should interpret as, after seeing this analysis, I should think that the L0 model is totally ruled out in favor of the L1 model. In other words, this is evidence that we can, in fact, understand how generics are interpreted, how they're learned from, and it's that they are not only minimal examples, they're intended minimal examples, socially interpreted examples. By the way, this data we haven't actually finalized. Well, we finalized it, but we haven't submitted it because we're slow. But the same model is in a model of generic endorsement data that's coming out in Psych Review now or sometime in the next few months. Again, we're able to explain the variation in generic endorsement, puzzling cases like birds lay eggs and birds are female, extremely well with this kind of model. So you can take a look at this paper if you're interested in seeing the model. Okay, so let's wrap up. So what's the picture? I started by saying the puzzle is how people come to know so much from relatively little in terms of time and data. So we need to explain how knowledge gets into our heads. And the first step was to say, well, if you have a powerful language of thought and a powerful learning mechanism that can learn from examples, you can get knowledge into your head. And I first showed that you can get a fair amount of knowledge into your head, and it's well explained by this Bayesian language of thought story. But then I worried about that and said, yeah, but language concept learning gets very hard for people very quickly. And so then I switched and started talking about the cultural ratchet view, where each individual learner is not so powerful, but in aggregate over generations, people are very powerful because we can accumulate that painfully won conceptual knowledge. I showed you that the cultural ratchet is supported by language. Language is sufficient for the cultural ratchet, and that it's generic and quantifier language specifically that seems to be important, at least with respect to this experimental domain that I was looking at, these bugs. I then finally said that if we drill into the details of how people understand generic language, that we can explain that, again, using a kind of Bayesian story, but here it's a Bayesian story that captures social inference, that captures reasoning about other people in order to figure out what they're trying to tell you. One thing that I didn't tell you, but I think is probably a very important part of this story, is that the conceptual knowledge that you get by way of language, of the cultural ratchet, I think actually changes the representation that you learn for future learning from examples in important ways. We have some ongoing work on that. But I think when you put all of this together, you start to get a story that feels very plausible to me for how we come to be able to do so much starting from so little. And critically, it's because each individual is pretty powerful, extremely powerful at representation and relatively powerful at learning, but we have the ability to accumulate knowledge over generations, learning from the painful work of previous learners. And that's all. Thanks.